much for listening. Yesterday in San Diego, the Democratic mayor of that town, Bob Filner, who is 70 years old, announced that he was going to go away for 2 weeks of intensive therapy at a behavior counseling clinic. Why? Because seven different women have filed sexual harassment charges against him, not just in the last week or the last couple of weeks, but over the last several years. There are stories of him groping women around the office or trying to kiss them and just big, sloppy, slobbery stuff that, to me, falls into the category of a guy who just doesn't know how you're supposed to treat women. And I'm not sure that going away for 2 weeks is going to change a man who is 70 years old. Here's what Bob Filner told a press conference yesterday.
I must become a better person. And my hope is that becoming a better person, I put myself in a position to someday be forgiven. However, before I even think of asking for forgiveness, I need to demonstrate that my behavior has changed. And that will only happen over time, and only if such incidents never, ever happen again.
Now, a lot of people have called for Filner to resign as mayor of San Diego, including some of the leaders of his own party. But when I hear stories like this, I think back to other people who have gotten into trouble and used rehab or sometimes sex addiction as their excuse. Oh, I'm sick and I need help and I need somebody to make me better. We've heard this from celebrities, David Duchovny, Russell Brand after he got caught cheating on Katy Perry. Oh, I'm a sex addict. Billy Bob Thornton when he cheated on Angelina Jolie. It comes down to the question of whether you can actually be a sex addict. Is sex addiction real, or is it just an excuse? Well, the Department of Psychiatry at UCLA has been studying this and has recently come out with the research. And Dr. Timothy Fong is one of the co-authors of that study and joins me now. Welcome to America Weekend.
Thank you. Good morning.
What did you find? Is sex addiction real, or is it just an excuse?
Well, we're beginning to find out that it is, in fact, a brain disease, but we've called into some question exactly what kind of disease it is. So for a long time, this question has been out there, is it real or is it not? What we know for certain is that when people come to our clinic complaining about hypersexual activities that cause problems in their lives, they're suffering, they're hurting, they've caused extensive damage. And whatever you want to call it, we're out there trying to help people and trying to come up with solutions to their problems.
Okay, so people come to your clinic because, essentially, they've been caught doing this. I'm guessing nobody ever walks in and says, hey, you know what, I'm a sex addict and I'm incredibly happy and I have no problems.
Well, you know, if they did, then we really wouldn't be in very much business either. But absolutely, just like for any other mental health condition, by the time people reach treatment, it's really serious. It's profound in terms of the damage and the consequences. Absolutely. People don't come in when sexual behaviors are causing them good things to happen in their life. They come in when there's serious problems, you know, problems with the spouse, financial problems, problems at work.
Is this recognized by the American Psychiatric Association as an addiction? I mean, if I looked in the DSM, what are they up to, DSM-5 now?
Correct, yes. DSM-5 was released this spring. And in fact, no, it is not. We did a research study to try and look at putting hypersexual disorders or sexual addiction into the DSM-5. It did not make it. It's listed in the past DSM-4 as various sexual disorders, quote, NOS, or not otherwise specified. But if you look in the section of addictions, it's not there. If you look in the section of impulse control disorders, it's not there. However, we know that these men and women, again, are suffering from some sort of condition. We just don't know what to call it. We also know that a lot of these men and women who come in do, in fact, probably use it as a cover for some other behavioral problem or for some other personality issue, and they will label it. Now, we get this a lot when people say, hey, this is my addiction. I'm a victim here. You should feel sorry for me. But in fact, I tell them, this is no different than any other medical problem. Now that you have this condition, you have more responsibility to take care of your life. You have more responsibility for your actions. You have to pay more attention to what you do, what you say, and who you spend time with.
Yeah, these always seem to be situations where somebody isn't taking responsibility, saying, I can't help myself here. You know, like that woman a couple of years ago who kept going to the tanning parlor. She got caught once when she took her little underage girl with her there. And, you know, she was horribly tanned and not attractive to anybody, but I guess she considered herself a tanning addict. Or you hear about people who are shopping addicts.
Right,
is that where
right.
sex
and, you know,
addiction
when you're
is?
In the throes of a... addictive disorder or compulsive behaviors, you know, your insight, your judgment, they're not there. I mean, that by definition, that what makes it pathological. Every single one of our patients who come into our clinic, they don't ask for these sorts of things. They don't want to be in these situations. By definition, it's the nature of this condition that causes them to deny, to reject, to say, this isn't true, this isn't my fault, to point the finger somewhere else. And it's part of our job to try and help people turn that pointer back on themselves and say, what do I need to do to remain healthy?
And so then is the way you treat them to teach them about how to control their impulses?
Well, yeah, that's part of it. Just like any other form of addictive disorder or mental psychiatric condition, we use a combination of medications, psychotherapy, social treatments, really to get people to recover and take responsibility for their own lives and their own actions. So exactly. It's not just a one-and-done, two-hour session or even 2 weeks. You know, it's a long-term process of recovery and self-discovery that gets people better.
Is there a line here where you have to be careful in calling something a disease? Because if something's a disease, then there is money to be made from treating it. And Big Pharma is going to be interested in developing a pill that will help people, you know, get over it.
Right. Well, you know, there's big money in not calling it a disease as well. I mean, there's big money in people who are saying, I need help. Here's some money to help take my problems away. When I think define a disease, this means that a organ in our body is not working in the same way, whether it's in America or England or Asia. It's clear, reproducible signs and illness. So we have not yet established that for sex addiction. We know that there are certain parts of the brain, though, that are affected by these hypersexual behaviors, but we haven't been able to prove that it looks exactly like drug and alcohol addiction. Big Pharma is also a big part of the reason we have treatments for lots of medical problems like cancer, diabetes, alcoholism. But if you're the president of a big pharmaceutical company, it's not likely that you want to say to your stakeholders, let's get into the business of helping people stop using and engaging in sex. So it's one of these challenges where you see a cross between science and culture, society and morality. And when we don't have large and millions of dollars of funding to look at these behaviors of sex, it oftentimes leads us to do the science in a much slower pace than it would be, say, if we wanted to discover a cure for HIV or cancer.
Yeah, they don't want to make a pill that's going to stop people from taking the little blue pill.
Well, you know, the irony is that they certainly could, and the little blue pill increases the sexual activity. But what we're talking about, again, is a medication that will restore normal, healthy sexual functioning. You know, going to the massage parlor 3 times a week, having multiple affairs despite people knowing about it, going online for 7-8 hours straight, this is not normal, healthy sexual behaviors.
You mentioned activity in the brain. When you were doing research on this to do this study, were you actually sticking people into an MRI or taking EEGs of their brain to see how they respond to sexual images?
Right. We were using an EEG or electroencephalography, basically trying to measure the electrical activity of the brains. So we took men and women who self-reported that they were struggling with sexual activity and measured their brainwave patterns after they were exposed to different images. They were shown images related to sex, some images related to people just talking, other images of dismembered bodies. And what we found is that if you were really severely self-reporting that I'd have a severe sex addiction problem, that you look no different than someone who had a much lower sex addiction problem. So what was interesting is that we thought going into it that the men and women who self-reported having the most severe sexual addiction problem, that their brains would respond more intensely, more rapidly to the sexual images than those who did not. So bottom line is it looks like this is different than with drugs and alcohol, where if you show a cocaine addict images of cocaine, their EEG patterns spike and light up really intensely. That didn't really happen in this study. Now, this is a preliminary study. It was only the first study to of its kind to be done like this. So we need more researchers to replicate this. We need to try and do this again with a different set of patients and participants.
Very interesting. Dr. Fong, I've got to cut you off because we're all out of time. Dr. Timothy Fong of the UCLA Impulse Control Disorders Clinic and the UCLA Addiction Medicine Clinic. Thanks so much for joining me today. I'm Paul Harris. This is America Weekend. America.